This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us. Mark Dwyer is back with us today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. We're going to look at plants that add fragrance to the garden first, but we're happy to take all your gardening questions. So join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Good, Jill. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's so nice to see the sun after so much rain.
Well, we didn't mind the rain. We needed
no.
it, but it seems like it's October with the temperatures, but we'll take what we get.
Very true. You got to work with what you have, right?
Right.
We wanted to start out today by talking about fragrance in the garden. And I was just thinking, how important is that in the healing garden at the hospital in Edgerton?
Well, that's a great question, Jill. You know, with our 3-acre garden behind the hospital here, our intention, of course, is all accessibility, but sensory engagement becomes very important as well, and that certainly includes scent. So we're sort of headed through the transition of our earliest woody plants offering fragrance like Korean spice viburnums, lilacs. We're heading into lindens here, blooming shortly, and while those woody plants can offer some scent wafting on the air, there's a lot of other things we can do in our garden to have a continuation of that sort of olfactory contribution, as we call it.
Sure. I mean, I think spring, of course, lilacs, the peonies are just about ready to pop. But what are some of the less familiar plants with fragrance that also blossom at this time of the year?
Well, one of my favorites is something called fragrant abelia. And so this abelia is kind of an arcing woody shrub. And when it's in bloom in May for about 2 weeks, the fragrance is divine. And, you know, it's important to qualify that and say, you know, scent is subjective. Not everyone likes the fragrance of lavender or lilacs. But this abelia is unbelievable and just wafting through the air. And, you know, you mentioned peonies, and there's a lot of bearded iris that have wonderful scent as well. So I think people, as they go to their local garden centers, and they likely have already, ask some very pointed questions about fragrance to include not only fragrant flowers, but perhaps those plants that you can sort of scratch and sniff, those that require tactile engagement, as we say, to kind of enjoy that smell.
Sure. Now, what about going into summer? What are some that you like to use?
Well, I feel like there's less for woody plants offering fragrance, but more of our more tender annuals, tropicals. So at the Healing Garden here, we lean on things like fragrant stocks, which is an annual for us. It's called Matthiola, that has a sort of a snapdragon-like look and just amazingly fragrant flowers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think the real hit out in the garden has been chocolate cosmos. And this is a true cosmos, native to, I believe, Mexico and maybe southern Texas. Really dark maroon, and it literally smells like dark chocolate when you get quite close to it.
Wow.
Yeah, but our raised beds have scented geraniums of all different fragrances that people can rub and smell. But leaning on a heat, those plants that really like the summer heat and full sun, but will give you that 3 to 4 months of wonderful interest in the container or garden bed as well.
Great. Well, I think I need to find some of those cosmos. Now, those are annuals, though, right?
Correct. It's interesting, though, their root system is tuberous, so you actually can store them like you would a dahlia or a canna. It's a very interesting plant, but the you don't smell it from a distance, but if you get close, it's a true nail on the head, dark chocolate smell.
Wow, I love it. I love it. Well, we've got some calls, so let's go to Nathan in De Pere. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hey, Jill, I was just calling to see if there was any good-smelling plants that also offer any sort of pest control over chemicals or stuff like that.
Ooh, good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know some of the evidence is anecdotal in terms of, you know, is it excluding, because people will always ask, mosquitoes come to mind, like the
sure.
idea of planting scented geraniums. And there's actually, for the Healing Garden, we bought a citrus smelling it's called mosquito plant, which is really a pelargonium or a scented geranium. And the thought is that it excludes or eliminates mosquitoes from the area. And I'm not entirely sure that's the case, to be honest. So I'm wary of recommending anything that's a slam dunk for keeping pests away. But there are some people that swear by the use of that plant in particular around the patio or deck to exclude exclude mosquitoes in particular. But again, a lot of the evidence, I'm not convinced. I'm wary again of recommending anything specific.
Sure. What about using like companion planting? Doesn't that sometimes help control pests?
Well, when you think of things like marigolds, the idea that marigolds have been included as a perimeter plant around many vegetable gardens. The idea with that plant in particular, the scent of marigolds, now I will say I've seen rabbits and deer nibble marigolds, but the intention is the fragrance of that foliage excludes some pests as well. So there are these companion plants that people, again, will swear by, but I'm not sure, again, the evidence supports all of that. The other approach is using these companion plants to attract these targeted insects away from your good stuff. So I would do a little more research and reading on that, but you may get additional callers today that have some experience with that as well.
Yeah, great. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks, Nathan. Good luck with that. Next, from Madison, we've got Andrea. Go right ahead.
Hello. Hi, Mark. This is Andrea. I wanted to recommend two plants that I have next to the entry to my house so I can stroke them when I come in, and they release a wonderful scent. The Pelargonium attar of rose, A-T-T-A-R. It has a wonderful rose scent. And lemon verbena, you can't beat it for that wonderful lemony burst. And you can use it in tea. So those are two of my favorites.
Yeah. Hi, Andrea. I know Andrea well, and great recommendations. And I will say that attar of roses is an excellent pelargonium. Keeping in mind, again, to Andrea's point, you've got to rub to smell it. But when you think about pure lemon, the scent of lemon in the garden, lemon verbena is the best because there's a lot of, industrial pledge type lemon scented plants.
Very true.
You know, lemon balm, which is a kind of a running plant. Pardon me. But lemon verbena, lemongrass, there's some great lemon scented geraniums. But also to Andrea's point that lemon verbena is a very commonly used herb in teas and other uses. But we have lemon verbena and lemongrass growing in our raised beds, and our cafe will use both from time to time, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Is lemongrass a perennial?
It is not. So it's an annual for us. It would be a perennial maybe in Florida and in the tropics. But you get, you know, a good 4 to 5 months of growth with it. And it's not a showy grass, but most of the culinary use is in the lower stems in stir fries and such, but it's a really good one, particularly for kids. The idea of rubbing and smelling, you know, what do you smell? And the lemon is very, very clear and enjoyable.
Yes, for sure. Well, thanks, Andrea. Appreciate that. Let's go to Green Bay. Hi, Nick. Go right ahead.
Hey, guys. Just got a question for you. I bought a house, and we bought it during the winter, so I didn't know what this plant was, but it turned out to be a pussy willow. And, yeah, it was kind of neat with the little buds, but now it's just green and it's kind of drab. Is there any benefit to having that there? I mean, I'm not going to cut it down, but it doesn't look very attractive. It's kind of an ugly plant.
Yeah. Well, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
I was thinking that.
right. And there's, a lot of great willows. And when they're budding out, they're all gorgeous. And, willows are soft-wooded. They can be problematic with some spreading. I grew up with a massive weeping willow in the backyard and remember all the little branchlets falling. But they do have some importance in the ecosystem, and there are native willows and non-native. So I'm rambling on here to say I don't want to be the one to say take it out. Having said that, there are some beautiful willows that ornamentally have interest in the garden. I've been planting one in the Healing Garden here called Iceberg Alley. It's a silver-leaf Arctic willow, and it's a smaller shrub, but it's got this just silvery leaf. It's gorgeous. And I also have a willow called Golden Sunshine, which is bright gold right now. So there are more ornamental willows. So if you're keen on willows, maybe go to the nurseries and see what's up. But I don't want to be the one to say take out that pussy willow, because that's up to you, sir.
Yeah, Nick, live with it for another year and see how you like it. As time goes by, is that something that he could prune back, relatively easily?
Sure. Willows can be pruned back, but it encourages can encourage suckering and also and root suckering. So they're very vigorous, as many folks know. So the danger in the cutback is they will respond, and you have to deal with it annually then.
Sure. Okay, great. Thanks for the question, Nick. Next up, we've got Barb in La Crosse. Go right ahead.
Hi, I wanted to suggest a new plant. I just had it last year for the first time and got one this year called a popcorn plant. It's a cassia. And it's really fun because kids love to come to the garden and fondle the leaves, and they smell just like popcorn. And then at night, the leaves fold up. They kind of, like in a prayer plant, they fold in half. So kind of fun.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, great recommendation, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because the popcorn plant is a legume, so it's a nitrogen fixer. They grow well, and in Wisconsin, the little plant, 1 foot plant you get at the nursery by the end of summer can be 6 to 7 feet. And to the caller's comment, the yellow flowers are gorgeous, and if you rub the top of the buds in particular, it's the scent of buttered popcorn.
Oh,
and,
my.
We've used them many times in the past. It's a gateway plant for kids to enjoy gardening. The only caveat to that, the warning, I guess, would be it is a poisonous plant, so you don't want anyone nibbling on it. But, yeah, popcorn plant or popcorn cassia, look for it, find a nice sunny spot for it, and enjoy it. They're amazing.
Oh, great. Well, thanks, Bar. We appreciate that. Our guest today is Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. What gardening questions or comments do you have? Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again next week. We're excited. We're going to be broadcasting once again from Bayfield in Bloom. If you'd like to be in the audience, reserve your spot by going to WPR.org/presents. Just scroll down till you see Larry's smiling face, and you can go from there to reserve. There's no cost. It's just that we kind of like to know how many people are going to be there. So I hope we get a chance to see you. The whole bunch of us are going to be up there. But right now, we are talking gardening with Mark Dwyer. Mark, you had mentioned, you know, about scent bringing kids into a garden and making them be excited about gardening. What are some other things that we can do to bring kids in?
Is give them some ownership over a space. And I can use my three-year-old grandson as an example, because he's starting to get real interested in this stuff. But he has his own little raised bed, and there's gentle guidance, of course, but we're making sure he takes on the responsibility of not only planting, but some weeding and watering. And early successes are vital. The idea that, you know, perhaps having them grow a tomato plant or something that they can take from plant to table, I think is great, because I remember when my girls had their own little garden space, those tomatoes they grew as young girls were the best tomatoes they've ever had, and they certainly remember them. So having their own amount of space, having them help you when it's appropriate, and you can offer that guidance, but and even just getting these kids outdoors more often is vital to connect them, you know, to the environment and specifically gardening as well.
Now, does age matter? Because I follow your posts on social media, so I've seen your grandson Miles grow up, and he's the cutest thing ever, by the way. I'm sure you'll agree. But you started him pretty early. But what about, you know, I mean, is that too much for young kids? Or how do you involve middle school kids or even, you know, gosh forbids, high school kids?
Yeah, great comments. And I will agree, Miles is the cutest. So we'll just establish that.
Okay.
Thank you. It's never too late. And I've been involved with high school programs where many of the students have not only never gardened, but have not done much outside. And we all know the, you know, all the screens and distractions that our kids are in their lives now. That's a reality. But that connection to the outside can start with a simple container, a small garden bed. So it's never too late. And I'm happy that my girls have become gardeners as young adults. They've always been gardeners. But it's never too late for that connection, because I run into retirees that want to volunteer, now that they're retired and they're just getting into gardening. And for whatever the reason happens to be, we can make an instant connection, and we should always endeavor to do so and bring people along for the ride.
And what does that do for life to be involved in gardening?
Well, and statistically, they've shown it lengthens life. It certainly improves quality of life. And, you know, a question is asked of me, why do we have a 3-acre healing garden at this hospital in Edgerton? You know, why do we spend money on it? Well, it's been shown that those people with rooms with a view, quicker recovery, less meds, more satisfaction. People enjoy it passively from the windows or immersively walking through it. So when you think about how it benefits us, there's the fresh air component, the exercise, but also less stress. It's all been proven. It's just amazing. And think about when you're out in your garden and enjoying it, whether you're actively gardening or not, we just feel better. And that's a phenomenon that's just exists. So why don't we do more of it? It's as simple as that.
I agree 100%. And really, when you think about all the money that goes into things that happen at the hospital make us feel better, you're probably at the lower end, right?
Well, and I've had to make that argument, which is interesting.
<I bet. laughs>
Because when you think of return on investment, you know, making people feel better, it's hard to maybe establish that with actual numbers, but the feedback we get from folks, and incidentally, it is open to the public. We just have general visitors going through today even. I think it's a very great return on investment, and I wish more healthcare facilities would invest in settings like this.
Yes, wonderful. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have Will in Platteville with something. Go right ahead, Will.
Yes, hi. I have, well, now two mock oranges in my yard that I don't much care for. They're Japanese beetle magnets, and I'm beginning to think the mock is mocking me when I'm trying to get rid of them, and they keep surviving.
Yeah.
Do you have... Is this a native or a valuable plant I should just allow to live, or do you have any suggestions on its removal?
Well, you know, mock oranges, they're not native, so the challenge, you know, the question becomes, is that space more valuable if your interest is in something native? The short answer is yes, there's unlimited options. I will say breeding in mock oranges has brought them at smaller scale, more flowering. There's variegated leaf selections, there's golden leaf. So beyond that brief window of bloom, because going back to your comment about mock oranges, my joke is that there's nothing better than a mock orange in bloom in terms of fragrance. There's nothing worse than a mock orange out of bloom because it's just kind of a green blob, in my opinion.
Yep,
and
mine
removal,
too.
yeah. Removal is difficult, without a doubt, but there's so many other native plants. And go to your local garden centers and nurseries and with an idea of what you want for size and perhaps features, but as customers at our local garden centers and such, there's never been a better time to have a wider selection of amazing native plants. So I'm not saying take that mock orange out, but it sounds like you've already entered the battle, and you'll find something else to replace it, I'm sure.
Good luck, Will. I made the mistake, too, of planting them because of the scent. And like you said, once they're gone, it's not a very pretty-looking plant. So.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, so many other good ones you can pick. So if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And Louise emailed us. She's wondering if Creeping Charlie will smother any other plants. She said she can live with it if it'll leave her other plants alone. What do you think?
I don't have a solid answer because it really depends on the competition, meaning what plants is it starting to surround. So Creeping Charlie, as you see it displacing lawns, it actually kind of colonizes areas where lawn won't grow well. When I find it in garden beds, it's actually not that difficult to really get under it and remove it. So I'll circle back and say it's really tough to say if it'll smother surrounding plants, but I don't think I would let that battle ensue. I would at least keep it peeled away from your desirable plants, and keeping in mind it wants to take over the world. So, you know, be wary of what you might be enabling.
Keep it in check.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Louise. So we were talking about fragrance, and we talked about some plants for summer. What about fall and even into winter? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, evergreens that have beautiful scent. What else is there?
Well, it's a great question because you start to get a little limited as we head towards frost. And so there's not a lot of intentional options where you're selecting a plant saying, you know, this is going to offer fragrance. You know, our native witch hazel has a nice spicy fragrance when that's blooming. Here in southern Wisconsin, it's blooming in early October, but it doesn't perfume a huge area. And Jill, you mentioned evergreens, the idea of brushing by spruce and fir and pine. They all offer a certain fragrance, but we do become a little limited. I will say there's an amazing tree called the Katsura tree. It's not native, but when it gets its yellow fall color, just as the leaves start to fall off, it has the scent of cotton candy. And you don't ever plant a Katsura tree for the couple of days where it smells like cotton candy, but it's there, and it's truly amazing. And there are some things that do happen in terms of scent late in the season. So spring heavy, summer heavy for fragrance, certainly a lot less as we head into the leaner parts of the year.
For sure. So enjoy them now while you can. We've got Sherry in Townsend who has a comment for us. Go ahead, Sherry.
Hi. When you were talking about having a healing garden, I have a friend who has a company called Serene View. It's a nonprofit, and he creates ceiling tiles that are tree canopies, and then also he does hospital curtains that are all beautiful sceneries. And they're mostly, I think, in the West Coast area, but it's phenomenal what it does for a classroom when you walk in your room and you see this beautiful, you know, tree canopy, or in a hospital bed and you're seeing this beautiful scenery. And it's sereneview.com.
Okay. Thank you, Sherry. That sounds gorgeous.
Yeah, the studies they did even back in the 70s, it was folks with the same surgical procedure with the recovery rooms looking out in different views, and that included like a brick wall, a garden landscape space, and a landscape painting or photo. And they found, of course, the person looking at brick wall, it was a tougher recovery. The garden, of course, was nice, but what I'm getting at is even a photo of nature is proven to have a beneficial effect. And when you think about how that might apply in a healthcare setting or even schools, where there's just a lot of drab going on, the idea that I think that those are great additional features that can offer some respite and betterment for folks.
For sure. Thank you for sharing that, Sherry. You know, fragrance brings us to the garden, of course, but does it also bring pollinators, or is it more of a color thing that attracts them?
Well, it depends on the pollinator, but so a lot of pollinators are attracted by some by color, and many pollinators seen in ultraviolet spectrum, so it's perhaps colors or patterns we don't see. Flower shape is important. You know, you think about hummingbirds liking trumpet-shaped flowers on salvia and foxglove and such. So fragrance in plants is actually very particular for attracting evening pollinators, things like moths and other critters where, you know, no plant has developed ecologically to provide scent for humans. It's happenstance. It just happens that there's a plant called evening stocks that emits an amazing fragrance at night and for humans, but what that plant is trying to do is attract pollinators. It's emitting or wafting a little, hey, I'm over here sort of thing. So, again, fragrance does have a role in attracting pollinators, but it's particularly in the evening hours.
When you design a landscape, do you very often consider what it looks like at night or how it's going to smell or, you know, what colors are going to reflect, you know, like a white garden type of thing? Do you do that very often?
Often, which is great, because with pointed questions for clients, you know, getting more out of them, not just their favorite colors or what they want to screen a view or have a nice, you know, foundation planting, but to say, you know, are you out in the garden at night? And if the answer is yes, I'll recommend including more silvers and whites for that moonlit garden where those colors really glow as dusk approaches. I might include more fragrance closer to those areas where they gather, you know, a patio or a deck or a window box. So it really, with pointed questions and for folks at home with your own gardens, you start to think, where can I enjoy more fragrance? Where can I enjoy in my home environment? We're out in the garden at dusk for the most part, so we've included all sorts of silvers and whites because it literally glows in those early evening hours. So, yeah, it can be very intentional.
Okay. That's always been something I've been thinking about. It's like, oh, wouldn't it be great? some of those flowers, some of the whiter flowers that maybe open in the evening, moon flowers, are there others?
Well, there's a whole lot. Moonflower as a common name can refer to a couple things, and I only mention that because in both cases they're poisonous. So there's a vine,
of course,
and there's the what's Jimson weed is another what's called moonflower. But I mentioned evening stocks. There's a great one called why am I drawing a blank here? Gosh darn it. There's many evening bloomers. And here at the Healing Garden, we actually included the moonflower vine on some of our arbors. And that's because we occasionally have patients or staff that come out into the garden in the evening hours. So we wanted to provide that sort of wafting fragrance. Evening phlox, I think, is the one I was trying to think of. Just a teeny little flower that opens up at night. So unfortunately, you don't find a lot of these at the local garden centers, and you should certainly ask, but your seed catalogs carry a lot of these fun things as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Do your research. That's half the fun, isn't it? Especially in January and February.
Yeah. Right.
What are some of your favorite annuals to bring pollinators into a garden?
When you think of pollinators, the idea of providing nectar and pollen, of course, when we talk about woody plants and particularly herbaceous perennials, we lean into the natives because they attract so much more of our native wildlife. As you get into annuals, so many of them provide nectar and pollen for our area pollinators. And the Healing Garden here is very pollinator friendly, and we include all sorts of annual salvias. We have Rudbeckias, the black-eyed Susans, both perennial and annual forms. We do a lot with zinnias, cosmos. You know, a lot of your old-fashioned common garden annuals are just amazing for pollinators. And if someone were to say you only get to select two annuals for pollinators, I would lean into the annual salvias because you get bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds, and then zinnias for the exact same reason. So the sky's the limit with what's out there for pollinator-friendly annuals.
And those are both great plants. There's a lot of variety and color and size. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. What about perennials?
So perennials, when you think of designing your garden, of course, we think of progression of bloom. So the idea that you should have active pollinators, depending on where you live in the state and your latitude and such, active pollinators from the earliest of spring all the way till hard frost. So you do want a progression of blooms, what's blooming in late April into May, June, July, et cetera. I love Liatris or I'm drawing a blank on the common name, Kansas Gayfeather. There's a whole bunch of other common names for Liatris, many native species. Echinacea, the coneflowers are great. I mentioned Rudbeckias. But when you get into many of our prairie plants, things like wild quinine and ironweed, which is Vernonia, some of our perennial verbenas, there's so many great natives. You have to understand their needs in the garden in terms of what they like for soil and sunlight, and do be wary of providing what they need and knowing their expectations. But also, some of these can become problematic with reseeding. I'm on a tangent here, but knowing your plant is always important. But back to native pollinators or perennials, there's so many selections out there.
There really are. And speaking of perennials, tell us about this event that's coming up in September at Ulbrich Botanical Garden in Madison.
Right. So September 19th, which is a Friday, Ulbrich Botanical Gardens, which is exceptional. If you've not visited or haven't visited recently, do so. So that Friday, September 19th, in tandem with the Perennial Plant Association, which is a North American group, I'm a admittedly, I'm one of their regional directors, so I have a vested interest in this event, to be honest. But on that Friday, we're going to have an all-day event with three speakers. It's going to be offered as an in-person opportunity or virtual. Great topics. It focuses on perennials. We've got someone talking about plant solutions for landscape challenges, continual color without continual hassle, poisonous plants and their history. But I think one of the best parts of the day is the opportunity to go out in the garden and meet with the Olbrich staff and tour the garden and chit-chat with those folks. So again, that's on September 19th, and Olbrich has it on their website. And if you get online and look up Perennial Plant Association events, you'll be able to track down this fall perennial symposium at Olbrich. It's going to be awesome.
It really looks like it'll be a fun time. And there's a tour, some tours too, right, that you can add on?
Right, a limited capacity tour. So the day prior, September 18th, which is a Thursday, there's only one bus going out to Epic Systems in Verona. And if you've not been out to Epic Systems, it is amazing. And we're going to get a behind-the-scenes tour with Jeff Epping, who's the former director of horticulture from Olbrich. He's been very involved with the Epic landscape. So he's going to give us a behind-the-scenes tour again on that Thursday. And then we go over to the UW Arboretum, and we chat with Doug Stevens and Susan Carpenter, both involved with there's Longnecker Gardens, the Woody Plant Collection, and the awesome Curtis Prairie. So we'll have lunch at the Arboretum. So it's a limited space for attendees of the symposium. That's part of the registration package if you're interested. But they're actively taking registrants, so do get online and check it out.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to get you on as soon as possible when I heard about this, because I have a feeling that's going to sell out really quickly. There is a charge, but you get a lot for the cost. So check it. I might check that out myself, actually. The tour sounds wonderful. I haven't been to Epic, so I've heard wonderful things about it.
Yeah, no, it's you're right, Jill. It'll fill very quickly, and the nice opportunity for virtual is we'll have everyone will get the recording of the event for I think 6 months, and the speakers are Dr. Laura Dieter from Ohio State. We have Dr. Kit Carlson from Madison College and Susan Martin from Michigan. And these names may not mean much to listeners. All three are exceptional in their field, and it's going to be an amazing day of plants.
For sure. If you've got a question for Mark, we have open lines, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. We wanted to kind of highlight a few flowers that people may not think about. And it's kind of funny, you wanted to talk about alliums. And I just had a friend send me a picture to ask me, what is this? And I'm like, well, as a matter of fact. So talk about alliums. They're pretty, I think they're a great addition to a garden.
Sure. So, as we speak, the Healing Garden has about 30,000 of these, we call them puffballs on a stick, these floating
great
alliums.
And,
right. So these ornamental onions, as I called, and they're all in the same family, of course, as our garden onions, shallots, etc. There's just so many amazing alliums, including summer blooming forms, but these were all planted in fall when we did tulips and daffodils. So they run the ranges of lavenders and purples and whites, and I think many of the listeners maybe have seen alliums to some degree or another, but the real benefit is once your daffodils and tulips have finished up, the alliums are hovering there offering color now into June, and as those go dormant, you're planting other things or the other portions of the garden, other plants are taking over. So as a plant form, this flower architecture, these spheres are truly amazing. They're great for pollinators. I do want to mention some of these can be a little seedy. They can have some reseeding, but the majority that are offered at garden centers in the fall are true perennial. So you get many, many years of enjoyment from these alliums or ornamental onions.
What I like about them is there's so many different heights available, so you can really place them in different parts of your garden.
Oh, they're great. We have there's one called Globemaster, which has been around for many years, and it's a huge sphere. So that sphere is not one flower; it's hundreds of florets. It's an umbel. It's a cluster of flowers, and we actually let them dry in place on their stalk as they go dormant, remove the foliage, and then we stake them and spray paint them, which is many people do this as well. But what you get is this floating sphere of additional color because it dries nice and hard. And you can have your hovering sphere of color through the entire summer if you decide to spray paint some of these taller, larger alliums.
Very cool. What colors do you pick?
Well, last year we had a 70s theme event out here, so we picked all these crazy, we had greens, yellows, oranges, reds. This year we're going to do silver because we're doing a big red, white, and blue theme. So we're going to have some of these hovering above, like little fireworks hovering above this red, white, and blue theme of annuals. So we're overplanting this massive bed of alliums with summer annuals, which will take over the show.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that. Let's go back to the phones. Lori in Portage has a question. Go right ahead.
Hello. I had a moonflower. It was more like a bush. I got it the cutting actually, the rooted, you know, from a part of a bush a friend had, and this was about 30 years ago. It came up every year. It was a perennial, and it just had beautiful moonflower-like, but I don't think it was moonflowers because I've never been able to get moonflowers to grow from seed or anything. Any idea of what that might have been?
Well, it's tough to say. Again, here's where we get in the confusion with the common names, because the moonflower vine, which is the vine itself is essentially a morning glory, and nice glossy leaf. They're very hard to establish. So what I do is just plant a whole bunch of seeds and hope something comes up. And if they come up, they're good to go. But if yours was more bushy and if it had felty, velvety leaves and was like 2, 3, maybe 4 feet, it had white flowers that spiraled open at night. It's called moonflower, but that's Jimson weed. That's a datura, and that's what's extremely poisonous. And they're not hardy for us, but what you see is they tend to come back because they'll drop seed. They get a real spiky pod in late summer. So if you remember felty foliage, white flowers spiraling, and a spiky pod late in the season, it was probably that Jimson weed or datura.
Okay, thanks, Lori, for that question. It sounds like an interesting plant, but gosh, it's scary when you have poisonous plants, and most of them are, aren't they?
Well, in that case, yeah, there's a lot of toxicity with those seeds, and folks, just you have to be careful.
That's right. Just know what you're planting. What other kinds of plants that maybe people aren't thinking of, kind of like the allium, that people might want to consider adding to their garden?
Well, I think it all depends on where you have gaps of interest. And one thing you should be always doing is, well, enjoying your garden, of course, but as you're doing that through the season, start looking for lapses of interest. The challenge with lapses of interest, for instance, let's say you were looking at your May garden going, boy, I really could use more color. If you're considering bulbs, you have to address that lapse in fall with planting. And if you have fall gaps where you're thinking, boy, I wish I had more in bloom in September, you likely are addressing that now with purchasing late-blooming perennials and other plants. So always take notes and photos. To my earlier comment, there's just so many wonderful plants being offered by our local vendors. It's so important to get out there and see what's not just new, because I've always used the adage, you know, new doesn't mean good and good doesn't mean new. So there's a lot of great old-fashioned standard plants that we know will perform well. But start seeing what looks good and always know the plant's expectations of you before you take it home, because we're all guilty of loading the back of the car in spring. We're starved for color and we get home and we're like, where am I going to put this? And I'm not exactly sure what it needs from me. So maximize your plant success by knowing those plants.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mark. I've never in my life done that.
Yeah, I was referring to you specifically, Jill, but yeah.
Mark Dwyer is our guest today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. What gardening questions or comments do you have? Join in by calling 800-642-1234, and you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. You know, the Wisconsin State Park System is celebrating 125 years this year. And on Monday, we're going to be rebroadcasting some of our conversations that we had in this winter about the park's history and about the volunteers that contribute so much. That's going to be Memorial Day from 11 to 1 right here. Right now, we are talking about gardening, and we're going to go straight to the phones. We have Curzio in Kenosha. Go right ahead.
Hi there. First time participating in the Larry Mueller Show. I'm so excited about it. I'm an avid gardener. Actually, I'm a farmer because my garden has grown to very large area, almost 5 acres. And I am a beekeeper, but I'm very interested in any kind of pollination, but more of all the insects that I can count on my farm, I'm excited to see bumblebees. I am a potato collector, and I'm into actually potato breeding. The bumblebee is the natural pollinator because it's a buzz pollinator, and I am very interested to introduce more plants on my farm that will provide nectar to the bumblebee queens that fly very early in the spring. I know that there is a plant that is called wooden betony, I believe is the name of the plant, that I don't currently have on my farm. I need to research it. And anything else that that you know?
Wow, Curzio, that's amazing. Mark, do you have any answers for him?
Well, I think it's I should mention the wood betony. If I would do a little more research on that, because I know what I'm thinking of as wood betony is a non-native, which it's still a great pollinator plant. It's a type of stachys. So that may, again, have value. But in terms of more support for the bumblebee and other pollinators, there's no shortage of resources for incorporating native plants. And Wisconsin, we have so many great native plant nurseries, things like Prairie Nursery in Westfield. And I'm not recommending one over another, but I feel like a couple of pointed calls to some of those nurseries and even the Extension Service may give you a little more guidance based on your expectations, but also taking into account what you currently have. So, I mean, the list is extremely long in terms of what you can incorporate, but I think, again, a little more structured guidance would be best.
And Curzio, if you haven't already, check out the Learning Store from the Extension. There's so much information there, and it's so well researched and so well laid out. So good luck. It sounds like quite a potato collector. I love it.
It's doing a lot, yeah.
Absolutely. And the enthusiasm is wonderful. I love it. Thanks, Curzio. Let's go next to Loganville, and Robert has a question. Go ahead.
Hi there. Last spring, I planted about 12 what I believe are perennial hardy geraniums for a ground cover underneath a miniature hawthorn tree. And they flowered all year, they grew all year, and everyone died over the winter. The nursery said they think maybe we didn't have enough snow cover. I'm wondering if I should try them again, or maybe you could recommend another plant. Maybe there's a little too much shade for them. Thank you.
Yeah, great question. And I'll start by saying that perennial geraniums, there's a wide range of great selections that do exactly what your expectation was, kind of knit together to form a ground cover. Now, hawthorns are notoriously shallow rooted, so there is some competition to contend with there. But if you hadn't have said it, I was going to offer, I've heard so many stories of dieback due to lack of snow cover. So in my area here in southern Wisconsin, I don't think we had over 4 inches total over the winter. And so again, the stories, and including examples here in our healing garden, are amazing how many losses we've had. So I would absolutely try it again. There's a great variety called Biakovo. That's a nice one to look at. Talk to your local nursery again about reestablishing your geranium experiment, because I think it'll be successful, and hopefully we get that snow cover we need.
We all kind of like it when we don't have a lot of snow in the winter, but it really isn't good for our gardens, is it?
Oh, not at all. I know Dr. Brian Huddleston with UW has mentioned recently that they're getting a lot of calls and references to really odd dieback, and it's tough to, you can attribute it to perhaps other things, but the consistency with so many of us having lack of snow cover, I think, is a commonality. So we need that snow, as you say, Jill, that blanket.
And it seems like we are in a time right now where we don't get as much as we used to. What can we do in the fall to prepare for those, you know, cold temperatures that maybe fluctuate a lot? What's the best way?
Well, one thing in particular is make sure you're watering, particularly new plants, until hard frost. So a lot of, I feel, the loss due to lack of snow cover is certainly fluctuating temperatures of that soil as we get out of winter. The idea that it hasn't been regulated through the winter, so there's some abrupt changes and some shifting and moving. But that watering in fall, the desiccation of the plant, I think, becomes problematic, particularly for evergreens and those with evergreen foliage. So proper watering late into fall, consider some straw or loose leaf mulching as an additional blanket. But, boy, I'm in Chainsville, Wisconsin, and I hate to say it, but I wouldn't mind 2 to 3 foot of snow over the winter. I mean, bring it on. I'd love to have that blanket, to be honest.
Yeah, during the winter, I kept thinking, oh, my roses are definitely going to die. And my lavender didn't make it, and it's been there for 5 years and did absolutely wonderful every year, and it did not come back this year. So it was very sad.
Yeah, rough winter.
A very rough winter. You know, I was wondering, in the Healing Garden, do you bring in any vegetables? I see so many people who bring in food plants into their regular landscaping.
We do. The short answer is yes. The challenge we have is heavy deer pressure on the upper garden, the 3 acres.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lower terraced area down to our cafe, which is very conveniently placed. We have this terrace where we have horse trough planters, 300-gallon planters. We've drilled holes in the bottom. These are galvanized steel. And a whole bunch of other contraptions where we're growing fresh vegetables and herbs for the cafe. So that's safe from the nibblers and very convenient for our chef to go out and pick cucumbers, tomatoes, squash, any sort of herb you can imagine we have out there. And, you know, we talk about farm to table. It's a great concept. We have terrace to cafe here, and it's 40 steps and fresh produce right into our cafe.
Wonderful. Is that cafe open to the public, too?
Hours, but it's wonderful. We have an executive chef, and we get a lot of compliments about the food and the garden, and the healthcare is exceptional as well.
I'm glad you could add that in. I'm sure the hospital administration would appreciate that.
Right.
I love it. You know, those big planters, do you have, you know, soil all the way down, or did you do some kind of filler in that?
That's a good question, because deeper containers, sometimes you don't have to worry about having soil all the way down. And mm-hmm. my rule of thumb is, so these do have soil because they're only 2 foot deep. And so we want that depth for tomatoes and such. But if I were planting a tomato in a 3 foot deep container, I would do something else on the bottom, some sort of filler or something that drains well that I cover with landscape fabric and then put my soil over the top. So soil volume is important for certain plants, and definitely types of vegetables. But these troughs are 8 foot long, 3 feet wide, and 2 feet tall, and they're solid soil, and we're growing a lot of great things in there.
How do you keep it refreshed? I mean, do you add new soil every year? Do you add fertilizer? What's the best way to treat those?
So we're trying to stay away from synthetic fertilizers. In that specific case, I'll say our 18 other huge containers out in the garden, we replace the soil every year. We start fresh with our own soil mix. But those plantable containers, we take about half the soil out and compost it, and then we add a 50-50 mix of potting soil and compost. So we're refreshing it with aged horse manure, churning it in, making sure it's all fluffed up. And since they're so large, it's very difficult to replace all that soil, so we replace half of it every year.
And the soil you take out, you put it in the compost pile?
Or we might just take it out in the garden and fill in low spots, or we don't dispose of it. We find a use for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, you can't throw away dirt.
Right.
Our guest today is Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he's the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. I hope you can stay with us because Mark is going to for another half an hour, so make sure you give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Mark Dwyer is back with us today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. What gardening questions or comments are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Mark, let's go right back to the phones. We've got Marilyn and Merrill. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Hi. About 10 years ago, I planted creeping phlox in three different spots in my full sun perennial garden where everything else thrives. I have had almost no luck getting those plants to bloom. The first two or three years, they did, and then nothing, or maybe five or six blooms. Friends suggested that I fertilize in the fall and then again in the spring, which I did, and still nothing. Any thoughts?
Yeah, creeping phlox should be a performer, and of course your expectation is the beauty they provide. And for folks that don't know the plant, it's just solid flowers in early spring. They're gorgeous. I wonder, to be honest, if the fertilizer is the problem, because I've always had more success with creeping phlox in leaner soils with some benign neglect, you know, like the edge of a retaining wall or a sidewalk where I don't do much. And the concern with the fertilizer is it might be encouraging more vegetative growth. So if you're seeing them still looking nice and bushy green but no flowers, I guess I would ease off of the fertilizer in fall and spring and see what happens next year. So a little abuse won't hurt them. You may get better flowering.
Thanks for the question, Marilyn. I agree with you 100%, Mark. I had the same problem. I was babying my phlox and it didn't bloom. And then I stuck something in kind of in the corner and kind of forgot about it. And this spring, it looks beautiful. So there are plants that like that. So, yeah. So good luck, Marilyn. Let's go next to David in Osseo. Go ahead, David.
Hello. Say hello. I live here at the north edge of the Driftless region, and it's beautiful here this time of year. I was inspired last year because one of my neighbors planted like 3 or 4 acres of wildflower, and it came up, and, you know, as a photographer, it was a bonanza. I've just never seen anything like it, and the bees were so thick it looked like fog at sundown. My wife and I have also created a nature preserve out here in the Driftless. And, you know, one thing I've noticed throughout the years is there's a lot of corn around here. And I was just wondering, is there any kind of incentive to grow some, maybe take an acre of your corn field and then make it into wildflower? And that's kind of a global question I had for Wisconsin. And, you know, I ended up buying seeds at Prairie Nursery, your sponsor there, and just planted them. So I hope to have some green wildflowers. And they are tailored to your soil, too, by the way. You can get a pile of maybe 30 native plants that will grow in almost anything. So.
Okay. Well, thanks, David. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, well, I love the idea of a land swap for traditional agriculture for meadows or something of that nature. And I'm not familiar with programs or policies in Wisconsin, although they may exist. With a little research or some phone calls, folks might be able to look a little further into that. But the benefit of a meadow, as this gentleman mentioned, for pollinators, for beauty, the challenge I would mention if you're seeding a space is keep in mind you're contending with what likely might be years of seed set from what was there previously. So I've seen folks clear off an area or even use an herbicide to clear it off, and they look like they have a blank slate. They put down new seed or even plugs for a native meadow, and things look to be going pretty well, and then you're still dealing with dormant seeds, viable seeds from, again, previous planting. So there's a lot of vigilance involved with establishment, but when done well and using quality plants, of which there's many sources, again, in our state, you can create some amazing areas that do become fairly self-sufficient over time with a little directed guidance.
Yeah, those first few years are key, aren't they?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a good source is the Wild Ones. They have lots of information on their website, and they're always really great for helping people out. So think about that, David. That's a national organization that started in Wisconsin, isn't it, Mark?
I'm not sure of its origins, but I would agree that it's a wonderful resource.
Yeah, for sure. If you've got a question for Mark, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we got an email from Dee in McFarland. She lives on Lake Obisa, I believe it's pronounced. They faced west. However, their yard is a mess. They have a large oak trees, so there's lots of shade, and they get lots of wind. And, of course, this spring their yard has been completely overrun with weeds, clover, dandelion, among others. They don't use any chemicals or fertilizer, but have tried overseeding with grass seed in the past. They created a rain garden and a pollinator garden, so there's not a lot of grass. And they would like to naturalize the entire area, but they also have grandkids who like to play in the yard occasionally. Do you have any suggestions, I'm assuming, for that grassy-ish area?
Boy, that's a tough one. I was absorbing the different conditions, and then with the grandkids wanting to play, becomes a little more challenging. So I would encourage you to engage the services of someone local who can really visit the site and see the nuances of the sun. And because the challenge with the oak, you don't want to damage the oak in any way through any sort of major grading or soil modifications, but there are ways to incorporate understory plants in the shadier areas and perhaps segue or separate space for play versus ground cover establishment. So I'm verbalizing a lot of these platitudes that I think someone else would have to take a closer look and give you a little more on-site guidance.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Dee. That's going to be a challenge for sure. Bill in Oregon emailed, are there plants that need the first 6 inches of soil to be frozen for most of their winter dormancy? Interesting question.
I don't know the answer to that. you know, it's always scary to me when we have the mild winters, a mild winter followed by maybe a little bit of snow and I'm always hoping for the ground to be frozen solid by December and then get a snow cover that keeps it frozen.
Right.
The idea that people think the blanket of snow isn't to keep things warm, it's to keep that soil frozen and provide protection from a lot of the vagaries of late wet winter rains and soil shifting later in the season or early in the season. But circling back to the question, I don't know the answer to that.
Aren't there some native seeds that need to go through cold, but not necessarily be frozen, right?
Right. There's a vernalization process for many native seeds where they need to, they're better. There's many plants you would sow in the fall, letting them go through that winter so they're ready to germinate in spring. And some of that you can replicate in the fridge and such. There's ways of doing it. But, yeah, I don't know about like 6 inches of frozen soil,
that's
if that's
a
requirement. I'm doubting it, but yeah. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, I guess you'll have to look into that one, Bill. And if you find out, let us know. Tom and Nina, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We've got a couple bare spots in our yard. Our soils are alkaline, and we want to plant some flowering shrubs that will attract pollinators. And the concern that I'm running into is that the nurseries apparently are treating shrubs with systemic herbicides or insecticides, and I'm mainly concerned about the neonicotinoids. And first of all, is it valid that I should be concerned about that? And secondarily, if so, where can I find a source of shrubs that have not been treated with systemic treatments?
Right, and those are great questions, because the reference to these neonicotinoids, these chemicals are systemic, meaning being drawn up through all the parts of the plant, and they affect the nervous system of insects. And so the intention, of course, is the insects we don't want are affected by these when they go for the plant. The challenge is it also gets into the nectar and pollen of the flowers. So there's all sorts of horror stories of neonicotinoids, or neonics as they're called, being used on plants that have perpetuated the herbicide from purchase to planting to out in somebody's garden. So that is a reality. So the question, how do you avoid that? Well, you have to ask very pointed questions at the nursery about their sourcing. And some labeling does reference neonicotinoids. I've seen it, you know, like this plant has been treated or this plant has not been treated. I'm not sure if that's a policy or a law at this point, but there's not a good way of doing it without just simply asking questions. And again, that it's absolutely valid to do so for all the reasons we've just discussed.
Yeah, that question has come up a lot in the last few months or so. So I think that concern, people are probably aware of it in garden centers that be able to help you out with that, Tom, right? Good luck.
We sure hope so.
Yeah, for sure. Stu in Randolph, go right ahead.
Hey, hi, Jill. I just called to add something to the mix that I believe it was Dave that called before and wondered why farmers didn't plant more flowers in their land.
Uh-huh.
And I am a farmer. I grow corn and soybeans, and I did set aside a quarter of an acre a little over 20 years ago to make a wildflower garden for the pollinators and the butterflies and such.
Oh, wonderful.
And I found that I struggled for 6 years. The wind blew in some giant ragweed seed, and I fought for years for that ragweed not to take over the wildflowers. So that's part of the reason that we don't do it, because we can't control the invasive weeds. If we spray anything, it kills all the flowers. If we leave it go, ragweed and other things take over, and then you've got a bigger problem.
Right. And as a farmer, I'm sure you don't have a whole lot of time to deal with that, right?
No.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thanks, Stu. We appreciate that. That's a really great answer for that. You know, I was just driving recently, and I saw a lot of dead, I think, are ash trees out there. And obviously, that's a big problem throughout the state because of emerald ash borer. Mark, what kind of replacement trees should we be looking for if we have a tree that we lost on our property?
Yeah, well, great reference to the emerald ash borer is still doing its thing. And
yeah.
The concern in Wisconsin, of course, is we have 700 million ash trees, and a lot of them further north might be safe in time. The challenge with replacements is certainly just considering an appropriate sized tree, because both green ash and white ash were very common street trees, and some are still being treated and still exist in our urban landscapes. But that was a go-to tough-as-nails tree. So I believe the DNR has come out with some lists of ash replacements. And just for, you know, folks, the diversifying the urban forest is so important, because we didn't learn our lesson with American elms when they were wiped out, and then now ashes. So by having lots of different types of trees along our parkways, as we should, mixing it up becomes important. So there's a wide range of urban-tolerant oak trees. There's maples, lindens. There's a wide range of trees that can fit just about any spot. And when I was at Rotary Gardens in Janesville, we did a display in our parking lot of ash replacements. And this was 15, 20 years ago when things started getting moving with emerald ash borer. We had a wide range of really neat trees that are options. So they exist, and it's a shame what's happening, but that's the reality we face.
It is. And if someone wants to replace, like right where they had the ash, put one of these new trees in, what do they do? Do they grind out the stump of the tree? Do they have to do anything else?
Well, if there's a way to avoid planting in the exact same spot, I would do that. And it has nothing to do with what affected the ash. It's more, I've seen folks remove a tree, grind out the stump, level it, and then they think that that soil is ready to be planted. And it really isn't, because there's still quite a bit more settling to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen new trees inserted in those situations where they end up sinking and being below grade, which is ultimately problematic. So let that area settle for a year before you plant it, or just shift 6 feet to the right or left and poke something in, and you'll be good to go.
Okay, great. Jared in Stoughton has a question, I believe. Go ahead, Jared.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about planting micro clover in my existing grass yard. It's a very shaded yard. Grass kind of gets hard to grow there. I've done some reading on it. We do have a four-year-old standard poodle that loves to play in the yard. I was just wondering the pros and cons of it, and if the pros outweigh the cons, what's the best way to establish the microclover in the
yard? Okay, thanks, Jared.
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't have a lot of experience with clover. It's a great lawn alternative, and once established, does very well in leaner soils and a little bit of shade. So I'm not sure your exact situation, but there's probably better venues or information out there than me speculating in terms of your use of clover. But a lot of folks are leaning into that, and clover is a legume as well. Once they get established, they're extremely tough and durable. And I know people have included clover in lawns where they have chickens and a lot of foot traffic. So I just wish you the best with a little more research that I unfortunately can't provide.
And Jared, we do talk to Doug Soldat, who's a sod specialist here at UW-Madison, twice a year. So if you go to our website and just search for his name, Doug, S-O-L-D-A-T, I believe, you'll be able to listen to those shows. And I know he did discuss micro clover. I think he was with us in April. So that might be helpful to you. So good luck with that. Yeah, lots of people looking for lawn alternatives. Have you done any of that, Mark?
You know, the challenge I tell people is getting rid of, say, poorly growing turf and creating a garden bed doesn't equate to less maintenance necessarily. So it's important to consider what that transition is, whether it's another ground cover or you're creating bed space. But my personal home garden is only maybe 10% turf for the grandson, but the rest is all garden. Having said that, it's a lot more maintenance per square foot. So I'm not a huge lawn aficionado. I don't need a lot of turf personally, but there are some great options out there for replacements that become low maintenance and are self-sustaining. And I love going to Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison to see their meadow gardens, which include a wide range of short grasses, forbs, different flowering things, early bulbs, and great examples of very low maintenance, lower ground cover type combinations.
It's nice when you go to a botanical garden like that, and a lot of times we're kind of overwhelmed by the whole look of it because it's so beautiful. But is it a good idea just to kind of go sometimes just to focus on one area and really go through it and look at how things are planted and what the plants are? I would imagine you do that.
I think it's worth it. To relax with no interest in what the plants are, or plant nerds like me that have a camera and take
right.
photos of everything. But using Olbrich as an example, with labels and literature and programs and all sorts of fun things happening, you can get a lot out of your visit. And whether it's specific or general, and all that well-being we talked about earlier certainly exists in copious quantities.
Sure, absolutely. We've had a lot of interest lately in putting water in the garden, it seems. Do you like to use it in your designs?
Yeah, water features can offer an auditory component, whether it's like a little spillway or a waterfall, or whether it's a pond or a bubbling fountain of some sort. I just warn folks that they're never low maintenance, particularly
No.
when you start to when you start to include fish and aquatic plants. Having said that, when they're well tended, they're an amazing attribute and contributor. But I think I'm seeing as many water gardens being removed is added. And that's not a criticism. It's just a reality that folks really need to know what they're getting into and commit to the care of those features.
What about rain gardens? Well, first explain what they are in case someone doesn't know. And then why would you want to put one in?
Well, rain gardens essentially are an intentional space that typically a depression that traps water that's coming, flowing across the site or from your roof or a structure where, in essence, instead of it just flowing off into the storm sewers, you're capturing it and plants are using it and it's infiltrating into the subsoil as opposed to, again, becoming instant runoff. And the Wisconsin DNR has one of the best references for rain gardens out there nationally. It's amazing. So it's an online booklet you can find, and there's specific plants you would choose, and it's not necessarily plants that like it wet. It's plants that can deal with the space when it's wet or even when it's dry. So I think people would like it to mitigate some of the water that's coming off site and also deal with issues of erosion or problems with heavy water flow across maybe a steeper site or of that sort. But lots of references for rain gardens out there, and when installed properly, they're a real asset for your landscape.
What are some good plants to put around like a water feature or in a rain garden?
Depends on, so again, a rain garden, when you think of the types of plants, I know plants like rattlesnake master or ironweed, some of the coneflowers, there's a wide range of native plants that you would typically associate with a prairie that can also take it quite wet. And also those dry times when we don't have rain for 6 weeks and we have this depression that is just waiting for that rainfall. So there are different plants you plant in the lowest portion of the rain garden versus the sides or the top. But again, those references and manuals will give you a lists galore of what you can include in those spaces.
Okay. And in the last minute or so, tell us again about the Perennial Plant Symposium.
Oh, absolutely. September 19th, which is a Friday, held at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. Full day of fun. Three speakers, time to tour the garden and meet with staff. Lunch, all of that. And on the Thursday prior, the 18th, the day before, there's a bus tour out to Epic Systems Campus in Verona and then the UW Arboretum. And if you get online in the Perennial Plant Association and look under their events, you'll be tracked back to Olbrich. They also have it on their website, but there's you can attend in person or virtually, limited space for the in person and also the bus tour. But it's a great event. We think it'll fill fast, hence us promoting it many, many months in advance, September 19th.
All right, sounds good. It should be really fun. And Mark, it's always been fun. It's always fun to talk with you. So thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Jill.
You bet. Our guest today has been Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD, and he is the Healing Garden Manager at Edgerton Hospital. Check it out if you're in the area. Coming up next, we're going to talk about rhubarb, how to grow it, how to use it. Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Did you know that rhubarb is a superfood? Well, next up on Garden Talk, we're going to take a closer look at this vegetable that's also a fruit. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. Here to talk about the history of this versatile plant and share some recipes is Nina Murkaji Furstenau. She is a food journalist and writer and has written 5 books. Her latest is The Pocket Rhubarb Cookbook. Nina also has a podcast that's available through NPR called Canned Peaches. Do you like to cook with rhubarb? What's your favorite recipe? What questions do you have about the plant? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Nina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for writing this little book, because when I first saw it was coming out, I'm like, we've got to do that because I love rhubarb, and it's just everywhere, it seems like, in this time of year especially. Why did you choose to write about rhubarb?
Well, I think, you know, a couple of reasons. One is it's kind of an unusual flavor profile for many people. And it's such a sensation when it comes out here in Missouri, because we don't have as long a season as you probably do where you are.
Yes.
And so when it comes out, it is a true mark of spring. And it's so such a lively plant to work with if you are a cook or a baker. It's just a lovely, you know, addition to cooking, and both savory and sweet. And I found it really unusual to work with.
For sure. And you didn't, you know, you came to it a little bit later in your life, right? You had never tasted it before. Tell us what it was about rhubarb that got you interested at first.
Well, I think it's one of those plants that, you know, there are sour and tastes like that in other, you know, other kinds of dishes that we all love. Sour cherry pie, for instance, or, you know, there are dishes like that. And when I was a, you know, Girl Scout age in grade school, I would go to 4-H as well. And they were in the spring, you would see these sour pies. And I found them so fascinating because they also had that comfort of sweetness as well. And I just developed a palate for it. So, I really liked that contrast. And so that makes it a fun food for me.
Do you find that people either love it or hate it, and very rarely they're in between?
Maybe so, but I can't imagine that not loving it. But, but I have come across a few people who sort of make a grimace when I talk about rhubarb. And I think they just didn't have a good childhood experience with it. And maybe they had stewed rhubarb without much else. And you know, it can be pretty intense. So when our taste buds are young, sometimes that would make an impact in your memory. But most people really like it.
Yeah, that's what mostly I've come across too. Now, where did rhubarb come from originally? Were you able to figure that out?
I think so. So it's most sources and research sources say that it comes from Southeast China in the highlands. And it is a plant that loves cooler weather, and especially the original variety. It kind of trundled along. I should not try and say the word trundled on the radio. It traveled along the Silk Road when traders were bringing many goods from the east to the west. And I think was known as a medicinal plant to begin with. I think it kind of became more used in culinary uses after the rise of sugar, and it became a little bit more palatable with sugar. And also the varieties changed, as it did not grow in Europe. So when it came into those lands, there were hybrids developed that grew better in those soils and those climates. And those are the varieties that came to the New World in the U.S. So by the time it hit the U.S., a lot of the plants that we're used to thinking about that were planted along the back fence rows in a lot of farmhouses in the Midwest, at least. And those plants often were brought by European American settlers, often Germans, maybe French. They brought that with them because they were already well known to the European people. Mm-hmm. We did not have it here until they came.
Well, we've got a caller, Dennis in Two Rivers, with a comment. Go ahead, Dennis.
Hi. When my family lived on a farm, I used to just pick rhubarb and eat it raw.
Oh my gosh.
But then after we moved to the city, like a decade or so ago, my parents had rhubarb in the city, and I didn't like it. So I don't know if it's a different kind of rhubarb, or if there's different soil, or maybe my taste buds have changed. Do you have any theory on that?
Thanks, Dennis.
I'm sorry, Jill.
Go right ahead.
Ready to jump right in. So I think the it could be several factors, and I think you identified some of them. But taste buds do change. I think every 14 days when you're young, and it spreads out longer as you age. And also the sharpness of rhubarb might taste differently for that reason to you now than it did when you were young. But if you were eating it raw as a youth, I'm impressed, first of all. And also the, it may be a different variety, though I think over time, rhubarb has become a little quicker to cook. We kind of want things that don't take an hour to soften anymore on a stove. And so it could be a different variety, but I would think more your own taste of it has changed a bit.
And maybe when you picked it too, bigger they get, they don't taste quite as good. I thought it was really interesting when I was reading your book about it would take an hour sometimes back in the early 1800s for rhubarb to soften up. So yeah, Things have changed.
If you do that to rhubarb now, as I mentioned in the book, it would be jam. well before an hour was up.
For sure. Now, I had mentioned in the preview that rhubarb is a superfood. Explain why that's the case.
Well, I think it's just like a lot of plants that have absorbing good soil, micronutrients, and the sun. You get those in the plant, and then you're consuming that plant. So that is really good for us if we can do that in season. And I do think that is when it's not processed and it's fresh and it's out of a garden that's not using a lot of chemicals, it's a superfood.
Gotcha. And there's some good things in it too. Vitamins, minerals, fiber. It's really got a lot of fiber in it.
Fiber, and that was originally why it was a medicinal plant, is it was kind of the pharmacy for the old world, because people couldn't just go to the, corner and Walgreens or whatever pharmacy you use and pick up something that would help you, your digestion. And so grandmothers across the world and physicians and so forth realized how good it was at balancing your system and making you feel good. Even texts as old as, I'm going to mess up the years, but early Chinese texts, they thought of rhubarb as a way to feel good, just to be kind of in balance and well. The rest of us really liked it, because if we ate too much food that made us not have a regularity to how we digest things, it would help us quite a bit.
How did they prepare it at that point? Were you able to find that out?
It was the ground root. So it was not the leaves. It was not the actual stalk that we eat now. It was the root. Mm-hmm. And that it became very valuable for that, because as you could imagine, if you didn't have a lot of plants you could just go buy at the corner store, pills or any kinds of medicines, then a plant that would help you feel in balance is a really valuable tool.
And you could store it a lot longer than you could any of the fresh parts, I would assume.
I would assume so.
Yeah.
They brought it west with them, and I think that's how it got to be so well known.
Sure. Now tell us about the plant itself. Where and when should we plant it?
I think you can plant it now, but you're not going to see anything to be eaten from it for another year. But it's a perennial, so you want to put it where it will be okay size-wise after it gets to be mature. You don't want to crowd it too much. In Missouri, it gets 3 to 4 feet tall and maybe as wide. Now, I had plants when I had a place out in the Pacific Northwest, and I think that plant might have been 6 feet tall. With rhubarbs have these huge leaves that are frilly on the outside, and it would wave in the wind, and I thought it was from outer space. But in Missouri, they don't get quite that big, and I maybe that's a sad thing, but they are quite beautiful. I call them a handsome plant. Mm-hmm. They have red stalks and nice, pretty deep green leaves with the frills. And I just think they're gorgeous. And I actually recommend, I know you had a speaker just talking about perennials. I recommend putting it in your flower beds at the back, because I love mixing edible plants in with perennial flowers, because it makes a good use of your garden beds, and you don't have to have a special place for it if you don't happen to have a good spot for a vegetable bed in the sun. It's great. I've got mine in my front garden bed behind my roses. So they work just fine there. The first year, it's recommended that you don't harvest them. And after the second year, you might harvest them lightly. But after that, they should be, you know, pretty good to go. And in climates in the northern Midwest and other places like that, with that type of cooler summer, you should be able to harvest them almost through the summer. In Missouri, we get a little more heat in the summer and humidity, and I don't think we get them past mid-June very much.
Yeah, we can harvest them here right up to first frost. So once they're frost, you shouldn't eat them. But yeah, they're really nice to have year round. So we're talking to Nina Murkici. I knew I was going to mess that up. Murkici, first to now. She's our guest today. She's a food journalist and writer and has written 5 books. And we're talking to her about her latest, The Pocket Rhubarb Cookbook. What questions or comments do you have about rhubarb? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us next week. We'll be broadcasting once again from Bayfield in Bloom. If you'd like to be in the audience, reserve your spot by going to wpr.org/presents. And we'll be really looking forward to seeing you there. But right now we are talking about rhubarb. How do you know when rhubarb is ready to pick, Nina?
So you want rhubarb stalks that have a good color, that aren't especially thick, because I think that could mean it's an older, you know, it's been on too long. You want them, 18 to 24 inches long. You want to cut them and maybe twist the base of them, so you're getting them right from the bottom. You do not want the leaves, of course. Everybody probably knows that, but those have
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
I have a hard time today, but they have an acidic quality to them that are not good for humans. Let me just put it that way.
Yes.
And you want only the stalk itself.
Yes.
And so the stalks that I had out in the Pacific Northwest were really long. I don't think they normally are that long. I think that those were kind of, like I said, they could have been an alien rhubarb plant.
That just amazes me. When I read that, I was like, you're kidding me. That's so tall.
I did not know what it was at first until the stalks were red. And I was like, oh my goodness, that's a rhubarb. But it was a special place out there. But in Missouri, the stalks of my plants get to be about 3 feet. And I would say that's probably the max. You know, you're going to want to cut those more at 12 inches, 18 inches long. And they'll be, you know, an inch in diameter. Maybe sometimes they get quite a bit thicker. They could get a little fibery, more fibery than you want, if you let them get too fat.
I love to just like pull them. There's that wonderful little pop. It's so satisfying. I don't know why, but it really is. So now let's get to the cooking part of this cookbook. Now that we went past the gardening part of it, there's like over 60 recipes in here. And where did you get all these recipes?
So I am now apparently a recipe developer. I didn't know I had that skill, but you know, after 9 months of cooking rhubarb, and I feel like I could say that is what I do now, at least from creating books like this. So I would, you know, take the plant, and I would think, okay, it's coming from the East. It comes through, historically came through particular cultures before it arrived here. And what might people have used that for in the kitchen? Because I felt like that's a good place to start. I love food history, so I get a little nerdy about that. So I'm thinking it's coming through Central Asia. They have a lot of herbs. They have a lot of meat dishes that are savory and stews that are beautiful. And I thought, well, they probably were the first to use it in a culinary way. And I believe they were Persians and Central Asians. And so what would they have used it in? Sugar was not used in the quantities we use sugar today. So it was probably a savory dish. So there in the book, you'll see a stew with rhubarb in it. And I would, after I'd come to the conclusion that maybe this might be an interesting combination, I would look and see what's out there in the world already. And oftentimes there's amazing and ingenious cooks out there that have developed things. So I would read up on those recipes and then create something that I think would taste really good. And then I would test it. So what I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised by was rhubarb did such a nice job, because I think of it as a, you know, dessert produce to use. I keep wanting to say vegetable, but it is, we consider it a fruit, but it is a vegetable. So that's why I keep tripping up on that. But anyway, the fruit of rhubarb, we normally think of it as a dessert in lovely pies and cobblers and so forth. And you'll certainly want to make those, and they're in the book. But think about it with savory meats, because that tang is, it works so well against the richness of meat if you're a meat eater. And I think in the stew, it was fantastic. There was several times when I was really surprised. I just wasn't sure it would be a good pairing until I tried it. And I was like, you know, this really does lift the dish. I found that with lentils, which was interesting. I don't know if a lot of the listeners in your program eat a lot of lentils, but my family does. We come from part of the world where we make what we call dal.
Oh,
and
sure.
It's a really... you know, it's a comfort food. It's a home food. Mm-hmm. And I've never put anything like rhubarb in my dal. I can promise you that. But I tried it, and it was like the equivalent of, well, some dishes in India, you'll put lime or lemon in to kind of lift the flavor. And that's exactly what it did. So I found it really useful for that.
I saw that recipe, and as a vegetarian, I was like, oh, I think yeah. I've got to try that, because it just sounds so good, you know?
It was good. I still make it, because, when you're testing, 70 recipes for the final, 69 or 8 that get in the book, it's just... some of them stay with the family, and some of them, are good, but, maybe you're not your absolute core recipes.
Sure.
But that one is one we use.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Rose in Sturgeon Bay, who has a story about rhubarb. Go ahead, Rose.
Hi. As a kid, 3 o'clock was always treat time. And in the spring, around when the rhubarb came up, Mom would just hand us a paper cup with maybe a third of it with sugar. And we would go break the rhubarb off, wash it in the garden hose, and just sit and dip our rhubarb in the sugar and eat it.
I love it. I love it. That's a really
delightful.
Yes, and an inventive mom, too. That'll keep them quiet for a while. So, all right, Rose, thank you. What a great memory. Let's go to Nettie in Fond du Lac next. Go ahead, Nettie.
Oh, this is really interesting, because like Rose, my brothers and sisters and I also used to go out with a little bit of sugar and break off the rhubarb and eat it raw. Well, let me tell you, you do not want to eat too much rhubarb raw, because we did, and it's a really good laxative, let me put it that way.
No.
I am 75 years old, and ever since then, I'll eat if somebody else makes something with rhubarb, but I go back to that, and it's like, okay, maybe just a little bit.
Oh, thank you, Nettie. Thank you.
Those ancients knew what they were talking about.
That's
even
right.
With the actual fruit of the rhubarb, you weren't even having the roots. So.
Yeah. Well, like we said, lots of fiber. So thanks, Nettie. I hope you get more. You should get this book, because there's a lot of really great ways to eat rhubarb that you probably hadn't thought of before. Speaking of which, we've had a couple of listeners email us that their rhubarb crisp is always runny. Now, they've tried cornstarch, they've tried maceration with sugar to pull the water out. Do you have any suggestions, Nina?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think I've probably used cornstarch in my recipe. I have to pull it up to look exactly. But it is a moist, it has a lot of water in it. So if you are concerned about too much moisture, there is another way I got this from when I was making blueberry pies. You can take a green apple and you can grate it, and then you can put it in a clean towel and twist the water out of the apple. So it's really dry when you're done twisting the towel. And you can put that in your rhubarb. It's going to have a sour profile as well. It won't take away from the flavor of the rhubarb, but it will absorb extra moisture in your cobbler or whatever you're attempting to make. And it isn't adding any more starch.
Yeah, and I do that with blueberry pie for the same reason. Yeah. You do say 3 tablespoons of quick cooking tapioca.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I can remember after nearly 7 years.
Sure. You can't remember all these recipes by heart? I'm surprised.
I don't know if trying the tapioca would be helpful in this case, but I didn't have the problem of having it be too much liquid. It seemed to work pretty well for me.
Okay. Well, there's some suggestions for you. So hopefully one of those will work. Kevin called, but he couldn't stay with us. And he wants to know, how can you tell if your rhubarb is too mature to harvest?
I was using pretty mature rhubarb because I had like 40 pounds of it that I was trying to store up from all my testing through the year. And so some of it that I got early in the season was quite tender and young, but some of it was a little bit thicker and more fibery. You just end up cooking it longer. I don't know that you can't use it. I don't think there's a time that you have, well, maybe there is, but I didn't ever not use a stalk of rhubarb. I was able to salvage it. It may just take a little more, attention at the stove.
Yeah. And you don't take the really young ones and you don't take the really old ones. You take the middle ones, and you shouldn't harvest all of the rhubarb in one season anyway. You should leave some.
I would say a third of the plant. You don't want to take it all. And also, one way to tell, and maybe this isn't, something everybody knows, but the plants, they have really large leaves, but some of the stalks have smaller leaves, and those are the ones probably you want to pick, because if they get really large leaves, they're probably older.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And they're kind of hidden underneath those big leaves. Yeah. So I was really, I like to try a lot of these recipes, but the ones that really grabbed me right away were the drink ones. And I thought, what a wonderful addition to a drink. Do you have a favorite?
Well, I like anything bubbly, so I like those. Let me see if I can. I don't want to like rattle pages in front of you, but
that's okay. I've got it. I can rattle pages too. Okay. So
So the drinks were delicious because I like that flavor, that sweet tart flavor is so refreshing, especially on a hot day. And if you're outside, anything bubbly makes me happy. So I'm very, very easy to please when it comes to things like that. But I'm not as big on a lot of alcohol, but I really did like the rhubarb spritzer because it's with Prosecco, my favorite, light, bubbly, celebratory kind of drink.
Yeah.
I also really like lassis. That's also from my family's part of the world. And if you like the tart taste, it's beautiful in a lassi. And what lassi is, it's a little bit like a smoothie, what we call a smoothie here, but it's lighter. It's yogurt and it's a bubbly water, or in India and on the street vendors, they would just beat it for a long time. But we have ways of making that easier. So I use bubbly water, and then I would use rhubarb, and you can sweeten it with honey or sugar. I do sweeten it a little bit, but I actually really cherish that kind of tart, frothy taste when it's hot outside. It just makes me really cool. And that, so I do like that drink a lot.
Well, I experienced lemonade with mint in San Francisco a few years back, and I just love it. But you have mint lemonade with rhubarb, so I definitely want to try that one.
That'd be a good one.
Sure. We don't have too much time here, but I did have a question to ask you. Now, you have a cobbler, a buckle, a crumble, a crisp, and a Betty, okay? They're all similar, but they're similar. Different. Do people ask you about the definitions on those?
I think probably people intuitively know, because those words come from what they look like, right?
Right, so that's true.
Cobbler's kind of cobbled at the top. A crisp is a little bit more crunchy. Something that's buckle, think about that, is sort of buckling in because the fruit's sinking. So there is a reason for those names. And I kind of did that on purpose because I like using those names.
Except for Betty. I'm not quite sure about
that.
That's
a little harder. That one was a little, I think it's historically buried in time. Why? It was called a Betty.
Did any of these recipes really surprise you? You talked about, some of them, like the lentil dish, but were there some others?
Well, I just really, So it's not surprising, but in a way, it reinforced the idea that those classic flavors of rhubarb and strawberry do taste wonderful together. There's a reason all of our families, you know, do like that and have liked it for generations, and it is really good. The surprise for me, I've been around a lot of cooks recently during this book, and one of the wonderful ladies I met in New York State at a dairy farm that's organic, she made a cobbler with rhubarb. And no, she actually put strawberries in hers. I put the rhubarb in for the recipes in the book, but it was delicious. And I, you know, there's a lot of great cobbler recipes, and many of the listeners probably have one that's their favorite. So you'll have to see if you check out the one that's in this book. It is, you put the dough on the top of the fruit, and then this is the part that freaked me out. You put a cup of boiling water over that dough. It does not feel natural, let me tell you this. It maybe does for other people, but it bakes up really well with a little crunch on top.
Okay, wonderful. Oh, Nina, it's been so good to talk with you. And everybody, run out and get this, the Pocket Rhubarb Cookbook. It's really small and it's chock full of really good things. So thank you so much for being with us. And thank you for listening to us. This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Have a wonderful weekend.